Those computers online. Archiving 44K. Initiate sequence.
T minus 30 seconds.
Server connection confirmed.
T minus 25 seconds.
Live stream for Q120K.
T minus 20 seconds.
Phone lines are go.
T minus 15 seconds.
Satellite uplink verified.
T minus 10 seconds.
Flight check complete. Satellite uplink verified.
5, 4, 3, 2.
Welcome to Black Op Radio, the voice of political conspiracy research. You're listening to Black Op Radio, the show NSA doesn't want you to hear. Now here is your host, Leno Sanic.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and today we are speaking to Barbara Shearer, the director and executive producer of the film JFK, What the Doctors Saw. Hello, Barbara.
Hello, Len. Nice to meet you.
Thank you very much for giving me time today. You have a documentary. It's actually magnificent. There's so much to the production that I really want to compliment you on. But first of all, I just want to know, so people are interested, where can you find this right now and where is it available? And then we'll get into the details.
Sure. So it's streaming right now on Paramount Plus. And in the UK, it is on Channel 5, which is owned by Paramount. So because it's actually made a big splash in the UK as well. So but in the US, it's on Paramount Plus.
Great. Now, this is, I mean, listeners to this show will know this, but this is JFK, What the Doctors Saw. So what was a catalyst to get your interest in the JFK and the fact that there would be doctors would see maybe conflicting views on the topic? Like, what got you into JFK?
Well, it's a bit complicated because I came a little later, but there are seven doctors in our documentary, five of whom have passed away. And those seven doctors, those interviews were done over 10 years ago by a couple who are also exec producers on the series, on the show. It's Jacqueline Luth and Bill Garnett. It's a couple, they had a personal passion for this subject matter and sought out seven of the doctors and interviewed them on their own. So they weren't working for a network at that point. So
was in 2013?
Yes, exactly. So the footage in the documentary, in my documentary, the footage of the doctors is about 10 years old at that point. And then I was brought in when Paramount Plus. So Jackie, my understanding is Jackie and Bill brought the footage to my execs at Paramount Plus, who are Terry Wrong and Susan Zirinsky. And they said, we've got all this amazing footage of these seven doctors who were at Parkland, who first tended to JFK, the day of the assassination, and we want to make a show out of it. So they brought me in because I had just finished another show for them. And they said, listen, we want you to go through all this footage and make a show about these doctors. So that was about 2,000 pages worth of transcripts. And like, I obviously all the video, but the transcripts of what I dove into to figure out how the story would work. And then with that, I did three subsequent interviews, which would be Doug Horn, who I know you're familiar with, Michael Bodden, and then Matt Crumpton. So those are the three new interviews that were done for this particular project. So I just came on board actually almost a year ago.
Oh, okay. And the storytelling in the timeline is really magnificent. I mean, a lot of people who know the topic, I think, will be impressed just that you really laid out something. And in the research community, people looking into that, there's controversy as to start with, was there just one gunman? And then if there wasn't, how many shots were fired? And then how do they know how many shots were fired? And then as your documentary says, what the doctors saw, there's two sets, one in Parkland and one in Bethesda. And the further you get into it, there's complications that the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing, and they're phoning each other to do that. So you had given to you then this project. Did you form the timeline? Did you have to organize
Yes.
the storytelling?
Yeah. As the director, I put the creative and the vision on
Okay.
for what you see in terms of the final project, with my team, with the team. But basically, I was given, the seven interviews, and then we had to go through and mine the information and the interviews done with the doctors and figure out what was going to be put on in what order, et cetera, et cetera. And the best way to do it, we thought, was follow the body. Essentially, there's just, listen, this is a beast of a subject. As we know, the JFK assassination is just a massive, massive subject. So we had to really drill down and figure out exactly the story we were telling within 90 minutes. You know what I mean? It was going to be a 90-minute project. So that doesn't leave, I didn't get into all the information about,
Oh
who shot him or
yeah, that's
why
okay.
or anything. It's always about following the body. So that loaned itself, though, to a perfect clock in the fact how we did the countdown and the hour by hour situation and the
Yeah.
minute by minute
Yeah.
situation. So literally, we followed the body from the moment he was shot, right at Dealey Plaza, to the final autopsy and Bethesda, Maryland.
Yeah.
Just followed the body.
So you're responsible for that, and then you said your team.
We have a
You
team
didn't really
on
know
it.
too much about the assassination before this?
I really didn't. I didn't, as a Canadian filmmaker and someone who was not, I was not born when he was assassinated. Now, of course, I know it. I know, on a very superficial level, a
No,
lot of
that's fine. That's fine. But because some people have studied this 50 years and hearing about because.
No, I didn't. I did go down, obviously, though, because I was given this enormous responsibility to take this subject matter on, and I knew it was going to be a massive project because it's the 60th anniversary. Last year was the
Right.
60th anniversary. And because the American audiences know so much about this subject, I couldn't mess it up, put it this way. I felt the responsibility of, I can't mess this up. So the team and I went down a rabbit hole and we made sure we knew what we were talking about, and we had
Yeah.
to.
There have been other documentaries and other movies and, Oliver Stone and things like that, films,
Sure.
but your film, it really stands out for me in the professionalism that I was, I don't want to say not prepared for, but just surprised, like some of the mechanisms you had, like even that clock. And I have to say, on the watching the second and the third time, I started to get the feeling that the editing was done to a music, to a soundtrack. And as I was going along, I was thinking, you've got a favorite song where something picks up and there's a bit of a gallop in that. And then after the first minute or two, the film really starts to move, and the edits and the interviews of just a line here, a line there, going back, it really had a momentum to it, which, I mean, looking back, is like, wow, they did a good job, did they ever? And
Thank you. Thank you. And I shout out to the editor, Jay Baker, as well, because we do cut to music, by the way. That's not that you're not, you're in that business, so
okay, I
you
picked up on that. Yeah,
know
so,
that. Exactly.
but
You,
I
yeah.
made a note that the editor Jay Baker, I interview people, they talk about their story, they never mention that. And also, is it Bob Bazarc? How do you pronounce his last name? He's a sound designer.
Yeah, that would have been in post. That was
Yeah,
just done in the post.
Hell's Color Kitchen, Hell's Kitchen, Hell's Color Kitchen.
In New York. That's all done in New
Yeah,
York. Yeah.
that they did a good job on that because
Yes.
the whole thing.
The sound design was great at the end.
Yeah.
It was really great. I agree. It was super clear, and we were very specific about how we wanted it to sound, frankly, and look, obviously, in the color correct and sort of, but now we're getting into sort of the weeds here, but
Yeah.
anyway.
Okay. Well, I mean, that's kind of what I want to talk to you about because it's just like everybody will say, well, I know the story. He got shot. He's dead. So why would I watch this? And what I'm, telling people that just as a documentary, this is, it's magnificent from the color, from the focus, from the audio. I was even surprised in some of the interviews. I'm saying, where are they getting all that bottom end, low end? I don't see any lapel mics. And it's like rich and everything. The whole thing is very well made. And
Oh, thank you, thank you.
but
Yeah, I mean, I think it's what's remarkable about this particular project, though, really is the interviews with the doctors that were done so well years ago, because it's, you know, I would have maybe done some things differently right now, but I mean, had I been involved in those interviews, but bottom line, it's substance. The substance that comes from these doctors is really, I think, what sets this documentary apart. There's a fearlessness in a couple of them that I think we heard for this first time, you know?
Now, since those interviews were done in 2013, do you have a reason why it took 10 years for someone to put that together?
I have no idea.
Okay, no problem.
That's Jackie and Bill's territory. I think they probably wanted to sell it a while ago, and anyways, Paramount Plus came around and they picked it up and
Finally,
they
yeah.
brought me in.
Okay, all right. Okay, well, good for them.
Yeah.
Now, archival footage. It's
Yes.
amazing. I can't think of anything you missed. I mean, you have footage of almost everything from that day, and the timeline of weaving it in to tell a story is it's just I don't know, majestic. You know, it's just
Aw, thank you. Thank
the
you.
color and the storytelling and everything. It's the kind of thing you watch a second time or a third time. I mean, I do because I'm going to ask about it, but you
Yes.
know, it seemed to get better. You know, and it was like now I know what was going to happen, and you know, just like I say, like some of the technical things, like the recording, the audio, these edits, and then the topic is like, you know, that we a lot of people know, or if you didn't know, it's like, how is this that in this murder there's a crime scene, but in Parkland, and they describe it, and then there's almost like a second crime scene in Bethesda where these two things don't match, and that's where you get it, you know, never in 90 minutes would you solve that. You
Well,
address it.
no one's been able to solve it. Like, to be, you know what I mean? Nobody's been, it's not about solving it. If I mean, that would be a whole other documentary, frankly, or, you know, but it's just like, I think we were just sticking with the most, the soundbite, what these men came up with and what they had to say at this time in their lives. And then we bolstered that with people like Michael Bodden and Doug Horne, one way or the other. And I had to show both sides. I think it's very important, too, as a documentary filmmaker, that I present both sides to an audience and let the audience decide if they believe Parkland or do they believe Bethesda, because they were those two medical factions were very much at odds with each other.
So I did ask you said you're Canadian, but did you have an opinion?
After I delved down the rabbit hole about who I thought was telling the truth, or
Okay, well, what is your opinion on that? Because I mean, there's the Warren Commission that says there was a lone gunman, Lee Oswald, and other people who've looked into it said that can't be true.
oh, okay, sure. Of course, yeah, I definitely have an opinion on that. I think it and it's pretty simple. I that just can't be true, is my opinion. I think the Warren Commission had an agenda and they had to stick to that agenda and they made sure that the narrative fit that agenda. I think the House Select Committee, even though they came to their findings led to there being a high probability that there were two gunmen firing, but they were unable to identify the extent of the conspiracy. So they still sat in a very sort of safe place after their findings or their commission. And then the ARB were at odds with each other. But I think that they brought to light a whole bunch of new information that I think was really interesting as well. And I do think a lot of the House Select guys did too. Like we had Robert Tannenbaum on there who left the House Select. He was a lawyer on the House Select though. I mean, he disagrees with where they ended up. And, you know, and then I have Michael Bodden, who was on House Select, who aligned with the Warren Commission in their initial findings. So, and then you have Cyril Weck, right? Who
Right. I
makes,
got a chuckle out of that because I think Biden says, of the eight doctors, we had a unanimous opinion. And he goes, no, but there was nine. He didn't include Cyril Wechtel. So how am I
know.
getting up there and saying it's a unanimous decision
Yes.
of the people that agree with me?
You know what's interesting too, just as an aside, I agree and I love Cyril. Like we didn't interview him like either 10 years ago or in this one, but we used his archive. We, you know, did a quick little because he just summarized the magic bullet beautifully in my eyes. But he and Baden are very good friends, even though they sit
Oh,
on
different.
opposite sides of that desk. It's great. It's
Yeah,
great.
and he was friends with
Go ahead.
Arlen Specter as well, which is beyond my comprehension.
Sorry, Wecht was friends with Spectre or Bob?
No,
Okay.
both. Yeah, they became friends and they spoke together. I wouldn't want to be in the same room with Specter. I mean, the fraud that
Well,
they perpetrated on the public, and then you can get back into the deeper thing, like, was John F. Kennedy the last guy that really was thinking of America and then the world together to do good? And this is the kind of evil he's up against, that they would get together and say, that guy's got to go. Don't poison him in his sleep. I'm going to shoot him right in the middle of the street and blame some guy. And it'll send a message to the other countries that, we're in charge here. And,
Wow.
that's one way of looking at it. But
Yeah.
yeah, there are still people that think the Warren Commission got it right. Yeah, there's flat earthers too.
Well, I mean, like I said, we didn't, that was not going to be my area. I mean, like, I started this in February and we delivered this in September. So we had a pretty tight schedule to do a 90 minute and deliver. So we had to really focus on the areas that we were focusing on. So I didn't get into the Warren Commission that much. You know what I mean? I didn't
Well, what I'm trying
forensically
to also tell
study the
people that
Warren
haven't
Commission.
watched it and inspire them to go to Paramount Plus and purchase it or Amazon, is that the storytelling of this documentary is very good. And for you to tell me you did it in under a year and you weren't really fluent in the topic is amazing. Because it's almost like there isn't anything wrong, a mistake. And then when you show two sides of the coin, you say, well, I don't agree with that. And Tannenbaum's right on, and
Yeah,
let me
okay.
ask you this a question this way. Was there any opposition? Did anybody say, well, you can't cover this? Or I'm just guessing, was there?
No, not at all. In fact, I've been asked that a few times, and there was absolutely no pushback from the network, which the only people that would make pushback would be the network, and they never did that because my direct report, you know, is to Zirinsky and Terry Wrong, and I worked with them, and they're running Paramount Plus basically, and they had no, there was no pushback. They were very
I'm not
great.
sure if this is if I've got my facts straight, but I thought I heard that Rob Reiner had a deal with Paramount Plus and he was doing something and then that fell through. And then he went on to just make
Well, he may
contact.
have. I really don't know. I didn't
No
even know
problem.
about his project actually at all. We did, that never even came up and might have been before us. I have no idea. No idea actually.
So in
But sorry, his podcast is fantastic. I learned a lot of things from his podcast.
Just spoke to him about a month ago. So, in your research then on trying to put together this timeline of how you're going to organize cut from one interview to the next, whatever, what was, I guess, two things? What was something surprised you, and maybe what was the most shocking?
I think a lot of things surprised me, having been fairly new to the
Topic.
more forensic aspects of this case. But I think James Jenkins is the last remaining doctor, or he wasn't a doctor at that time, but remaining individual who was at the autopsy and worked the autopsy with the doctors at Bethesda. So James Jenkins to me is really revelatory in that he thinks that there was body tampering that went down before the autopsy. There was a frontal shot to the upper right hand
At the
hairline,
hairline, yeah.
a forehead and the hairline in that they saw that they were told to ignore and never made the autopsy report. I mean, that type of information I didn't know about, and I only after reading his transcript, right? And he's still alive, James Jenkins, and that to me is just mind-blowing. And that was the stuff that we really wanted to make sure was clear and well presented to do him justice and do that information justice.
Now, the Zapruder film copy that you have, it seems unusually clear. Where
Really,
did you
that
get it?
was
And
I believe that one's the sixth floor museum. No, there's nothing. I think that one came from sixth floor. We used all the usual suspects, and that one's pretty much sixth floor.
Yeah, because you seem to have all the different little films of on the parade route and there it's very inclusive, right? Like from the plane landing, you
Yes.
covered everything. Yeah.
Well, that's part of, the process in terms of we have an archive producer that, searches
So,
for
like you
all.
say, your team then you had a
Yeah.
team of people doing that, right?
Oh,
Because
yeah.
it does seem overwhelming to me that in 1 year or less that you got that together. So archival footage, you had somebody in charge of that, and they just
Yeah,
hunted
we
it
all
out.
actually pitched in on that. It was, to be honest, it was a pretty small team in terms of putting the show together. Every project I work on is different, but this one was particularly slow. I mean, at the end of the day, I think there was maybe, six key people that worked on this show. And I'm not talking about the post aspect of color correct and the mix and all that. That's a whole other team, but that only took a few days, so.
Well, very impressive. Now, most of the people have passed away, like from the video interviews in 2013. When you were doing your timeline and trying to do your storytelling, is there anybody that had passed away that you thought, oh, we needed something, we need this guy, we need, is there anything that you couldn't get?
No, and we didn't go back to the Dr. Jones is still alive, and so is Goldstrich, Dr. Goldstrich. There are two remaining doctors of the seven that were interviewed, but we did not return to them. We didn't go back. I think we went back to Jones for archival footage, like for photographs. There was a couple of photographs that I believe his family gave us, which is our, loaned us. But that's the only reason we went back to any of the doctors. We didn't pick up any
You
audio.
had enough of the story there.
Yeah, it was all there. And anything that we needed to fill in, like I said, we used the experts, meaning a Doug Horne or a Michael Bodden or a Matt Crumpton. Yeah.
This is what the doctor saw. It's very good. I just had so many questions, but I think we've got to most of them already. And you had, didn't have any opposition, and you didn't have anybody from a network or so.
Nothing like that.
I
We
think it's strange that
it
nobody had done this before, 50
yeah.
years in.
That's a hats off to Jacqueline Luth and her husband Bill Garnett, though, because they went on their own and just sat these seven doctors, Parkland doctors, who were still alive down and did those interviews. And that's the footage, that's the gold. So I don't think anyone's done it because they didn't have those interviews,
Nobody had the initiative to get the doctors together.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Or possibly they weren't open to it, but they're getting on in years and thinking, okay.
Yes, I see what you mean. Sure. I mean, previous to that, I don't know the story, like whether they'd have been approached. I'm sure they would have been, but no, they maintain their silence for a number of years. There's no question. It was only when they were all retired and on their, in their 70s and 80s that they started that these were done, and I guess they felt a little bit more forthcoming. Thank goodness.
And what are the kind of reviews that you're getting?
The reviews have been great. The reviews have been great. We got a good New York Times review. All the papers picked it up. All the media did. I mean, it helps that it was the 60th anniversary, so there's some built-in media on that, or a built-in attention. But thank goodness we didn't mess this up, is all I can say.
No, you did a very good job. But sometimes when documentaries like, or even Oliver Stone gets criticism where they attack the film for reasons that aren't even in the film or
Yes.
documentary, and they give it a bad review. But
Haven't had that. I'm going to be on. Thank goodness. I really haven't had that. It's been overwhelming just to see how many people really like it and reviewed it so well. It's been very nice.
I guess that you don't really blame the government, but you let the viewer make that decision that something's wrong, people were lied to, and then further, this was in the case of a president that it kind of leaves you with the question, well, why nothing's really happened? I mean, they're still holding the documents for 60 years, right? And I don't think they're going to release them now. With the last thing with Biden, they just said the CIA before, we didn't have enough time, we didn't have enough time, and they go, oh, we're not going to release them. So,
Yeah, that happens every time there's a new administration. Then, one administration kicks it down to the next one that's coming in. It's just no one wants to be the ones that release it. No one wants to deal with it. It's not a good look, probably, for the US government. I mean, there's probably a a dozen, hundreds of reasons, I should say, for that. But it's unfortunate. But to this day, 60 years later, I still think there's a, there's a massive cover-up.
Yeah. And my point of view is that if it was Lee Oswald or something like that, they would be waving that around if they had evidence. But the
Yeah.
fact that they're behind it is they don't want that to ever, well, first of all, Alan Dulles said, we're going to keep these files held for 75 years, which is what, a human lifespan? So
Yeah.
everyone to be dead before we have released this, right?
Yeah. Well, I just think it's like, just from the project, from our project, it's like what those doctors say, they allude to the fact, well, two of them are very, very distinct, and the other ones sort of allude to it because I still think some of them sat on the fence a little bit. But bottom line is they think there is at least another shooter, if not two, if not, if not three.
Yeah, at
So
least.
because
And
there's the frontal shots, right? Gives it away.
right.
He also shot from the back, though. There's no question. One of them missed, one of them went in his back. So
Yeah.
there's definitely some shots coming from behind,
Yeah.
as per the Warren Commission. And but I think
And then
the
that's a whole other topic, because then you're getting into what happened. But here you're just talking about that afternoon,
definitely
what the
trajectory of what we
doctors and
saw.
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Entrance and exit wounds, right? And these doctors were trauma specialists. They were seeing 500 bullet wounds a year. Like, these guys knew what they were talking about in Parkland. They knew exactly what they saw and what an entrance wound and an exit wound looks like. And it did not fall in line with what the Warren Commission.
Yeah, I think early in the documentary, one of the doctors goes over the amount of trauma, shooting, gunshot, and accidents, car accidents they have. It's like, no, they're used to seeing something like that as
Yeah,
opposed to.
absolutely they were. They weren't, this is what they saw at Parkland on a daily basis.
Okay, good. Well, I think I've covered all the questions that I did want to ask you. Before we wrap up, is there something you'd like to say about the film that I didn't get to?
I think you covered all of it, Len. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you very much for your time. And people find you at IMDb.
Yeah, well, my background, sure. If you're interested in my work, I'm on IMBD, but on Instagram and all that kind of stuff. But basically, the show is streaming on Paramount Plus.
Right. By the way, I was just looking into your background, trying to do some research, and you've done a three-part documentary on Ghislaine Maxwell. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah, yeah,
That
yeah.
sounds like something I'm going to have to watch, and then maybe I'll be getting back to you.
Sure, please do anytime. That's streaming on Peacock right now.
Okay. I'm not sure if I can get that in Canada, Vancouver.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Oh, it's on Crave. It's on Bell Media.
Oh, okay. All right.
You can see it on Crave.
Okay. Thank you, Barbara, for sharing time today.
Thank you, Len. Take care.
Okay. Goodbye.
You're listening to Black Op Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Black Op Radio. This is your host, Len Osanek, and we are with author, producer, Jim DiEugenio. Hello, Jim.
Good evening, Len.
I never know how to introduce you. You've done so many things, but you're high up in the JFK research community, so people tune in to hear what's new from your point of view in Los Angeles and also the Kennedys and King website, which you are in charge of.
And let's not forget my Substack.
Right, okay.
Okay,
There you
my
go.
Substack,
Always
okay.
something new with Jim.
All right, now on my recent Substack, I reviewed Brent Holland's documentary. That's my latest one. Now, the next thing I'm going to be reviewing there is the new program that's number one at Netflix, American Conspiracy, The Octopus Murders, which is about the death of Danny Casalero. I was sort of familiar with that case, but I did a lot of reading on it from a lot of different sources. I'm probably going to do a two-part Substack article on this Netflix special. Now, you heard about the famous scene, didn't you? Nichols shows Sherry Seymour. Nichols is this really bad guy who's down with the Cabazon Reservation doing weapons testing, and he runs into Sherry Seymour, who was a friend of Danny Casalero, and he shows her a Zapruder film that has the Secret Service agent shooting Kennedy. And she goes, "What the heck was that?" And he goes, "That's the real Zapruder film." Okay. And the whole thing, of course, was to make her believe that nothing is what it appears to be. And so I'm going to be doing a a couple of installments on that because I, and now you just reminded me of something that I think you should tell the audience, that you have a personal connection to this special.
Yeah, Michael Riccone, Judo. This whole thing, the octopus, I think it also circles around Promise Software. And it was the software that was going to be able to open up back doors to almost any computer that you had. And they were going to give it away to other governments for free as some kind of bookkeeping accounting software. And then they would be able to hack into anywhere. And then nefarious guys got a hold of it. But anyway, yeah, Anita Langley, who was a host, co-host of Black Op Radio in the early days, in the very beginning, from day one, her cousin was Michael Riccone Judo. And I think when he was in prison, they spoke often or wrote letters or whatever it was. But she implied there's going to be a season two for this. There's going to be more episodes.
There is?
Well, maybe I hope I didn't let the cat out of the bag, but that's... yeah.
So, okay.
I guess maybe it's doing good on Netflix, and they said, well...
Yeah, it's very highly rated.
Yeah, so if you have anything more, right? And some of these murders and that are, you know, so suspicious, and... God, did you hear about that Boeing whistleblower?
Yeah.
And he found dead in his car. I mean, there's another one. I mean, the Epstein, you know, thing. They can't find the flight logs. They don't have the client list kind of. They have, you know, partial list and that. And Americans are saying, oh, well, I guess Epstein committed suicide. You know, are you kidding me? There's so many things wrong with the world. I guess we only can concentrate on a few. And we're trying to figure out that if John Kennedy was so important, we should try to understand what happened so we can stop it from happening again, right? But people have various interests why they look into this. And some of these other murders, like the octopus murders, and it's a story unto itself. And I haven't seen it to start with, but I heard about it, you know, in the early days of research. I think Dave Emery and people like that were doing shows on it, maybe Mae Brussel. But like I just said, there's so many different things. You only have so much time, you know, if I'm thinking about Martin Luther King and or Sirhan Sirhan, you know, and William Pepper, and, you know, there's only so many times. So that's why people go to Kennedy's and King to check your reviews and see what's worth watching, see what's look worth, you know, and maybe just food for thought. Some of these things aren't, you know, people try their best, and they might not be 100% accurate, but generally it's good to hear that something is popular where it's trying to expose wrongdoings. Yeah.
All right, now, you had Johnny Cairns on.
Yes.
Talking about the Thomas Mallon, Ruth Payne, tete-a-tete in Irving. Okay. He's always a good. He's got a new article coming up for us, by the way, on, I think her name is Dean Silman, had a new book about Oswald. He's going to be reviewing that for us. Okay. Johnny's a very important contributor. You know, and he's a young guy also.
Yeah. And like with so many crappy things out there, it's really good to find somebody that you know, that you recommend or it's worth reading. And as we've said many times, we don't all agree on everything, but Kennedy's and King is a good place to start.
Right. Thank you. All right. Now, latest we have is a review of Tim Smith's book, which is called Hidden in Plain Sight, in which he examined the testimony of every single witness in from the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And a couple of instances, he went behind the scenes to go ahead and expose some of the subterfuge that was happening there. Okay, and you're probably going to have him on your show fairly soon. Okay, so that's a nice, take a look at the review, and then you can go ahead and listen to Len interview Tim about his book about the House Select Committee on Assassinations. Now, the other latest thing I have up, it took me literally weeks upon weeks upon weeks to do this. I actually saw Blonde, that Brad Pitt, Joyce Carol Oates piece of crap. I actually saw that on Netflix, all right? And then I found out that that wasn't the first film version of the Joyce Carol Oates novel, that there had been a previous version by Robert Greenwald, who's a pretty intelligent guy. I actually talked to him once, famous producer in Hollywood. So I had to watch that one too. And I wrote a two-part article on this called Brad Pitt, Joyce Carol Oates, and The Road to Blonde, in which I did a lot of reading from people like Gary Vitaco Robles, like Don McGovern, who's been a guest on your show more than once, Marilyn Monroe blogger April Vivea. And these were all important contributions to this two-part article. And all I can say, if you read this, you'll understand why this is just a big cesspool of character assassination all the way. And it culminated in this Brad Pitt-produced piece of garbage, okay, which I don't even know. I mean, I would hope that he didn't even read the script, because the script was just so awful. You know, it was just, you know, hard to believe that a guy who I think is pretty bright, okay, would go ahead and produce something like this. But evidently, he had a relationship with the director, Andrew Dominik. He did a couple of films with him. And that's what encouraged him to go over the edge into this abyss. So that's the other latest thing, which if you want to, we can talk about that later. Maybe you want to bring in Don McGovern, you know, for a three-way conversation on that one. Now, upcoming, I'm going to review the Rob Reiner special, the radio special, which you already had him on. I didn't even know that the late John Hunt wrote a book about the RFK case. Did you know that?
No, I didn't. Not about the RFK, no.
Yeah, John Hunt wrote a book about the RFK case, which Deborah Conway released on ebook. I didn't even know that. Okay, and Libby Handros, who you've also had on before, has released part one of her multi-part series, Four Who Tried. There was a prologue first, which I discussed on my Substack. Okay, now she has part one on, which is supposed to be what it was like before those assassinations. I might do that. Jerry Frisella, who's done an article for us, I might have him do that. But we're definitely going to get to that. And Johnny Cairns is going to review Dean Silman's book on Oswald. And Johnny's always good, no matter what he does. So that's what is upcoming. All right, now, I just did a coast-to-coast interview with Oliver Stone on Friday night with Richard Surrett. He does the conspiracy show up in Canada, and he's a guest host on Coast to Coast. Then tomorrow I'm doing an interview with Jeff Morley on his Substack. No, excuse me, on his JFK Facts interview show. So, as usual, I'm always pretty busy out there talking this up and talking this up and talking this up. And the letters never stop. I guess that's good. Okay, and so let me get to some of these. Now, first of all, let me say something. The kind of listeners we have on this show are really kind of amazing. All right. I had someone, she doesn't want her name to be revealed. All right, but she wanted to send me this book that, a very thin volume that was published back in 1965. This was like a year after Kennedy was killed, maybe a little bit more than that. The author of the book is Violet Parinjati. She's from India. The title of the book is President John Kennedy, Creative Statesmanship in the Field of Foreign Affairs. This book, it really, I believe, it has to be the first book ever published that tries to make the case in an oblique kind of way that Kennedy was killed due to his foreign policy vision. And she bases the book largely on his speeches, okay, as both a senator and as a president, all right? And it's really, really remarkable, a remarkable book. You know, today, you know, it wouldn't be very very shocking or anything like that. But to think that she wrote this in 1965, you know, and it's based upon his speeches in the Senate, like his Algeria speech in 1957, and then what he tried to do as president, okay, and how he tried to appeal to a feeling of cooperation among nations rather than one of conflict. And I was so glad that this person who shall remain nameless, because she doesn't want her name out there, that she went ahead and sent me this book, because I would have never even thought of looking about it. And she, I don't know how the heck she found it, but it's really nice to know that somebody was out there from India in 1965, okay, who was actually insightful enough to realize that what a great loss we had. Now, one of the books that she bases this on is the speeches in The Strategy of Peace. And if you have not read that book, if you have not read The Strategy of Peace, then you really should go ahead. It's a compendium of his speeches that was put together during his run for the presidency. And it includes the Algeria speech. And when I read that book, and she obviously read it too because she's got so many footnotes to it, I began to understand a little about what the establishment was doing with the reputation of John F. Kennedy, because that was a real eye-opener to me. Okay, now let's get to some of the letters. All right, okay, let's take a look. I'm going to try and do this in order.
Yeah, and like you mentioned, we get letters from all over the world, and people are very knowledgeable, and it's not, you know, it's always kind of really interesting, the questions we get.
Boy, you're not kidding.
Yeah.
That one threw me for a loop. Okay, so let's start. Mr. Endicott, February the 20th, Hamlin Endicott. I want to say that that's the best bibliography in Destiny Betrayed I have ever encountered in a JFK book. It is comprehensive for sure. Well, thank you so much. I do have a few questions. The time frame of Oswald traveling back from Mexico has him entering the U.S. and arriving in Dallas 1 hour and 10 minutes later. Did he fly? If so, who flew him? Well, okay. Look, the return from Mexico City to Dallas in the Warren Commission is an absolute joke. Okay, it was clearly put together under duress by the Secretary of the Interior, Mr. Echevarria, and his handmaiden, all right, or his right-hand man, Ochoa. And they could not find any way for him to get back from Mexico City. So they threw something together that is so fraudulent that it's very easy to see that they really didn't give a tinker's damn about whether or not it was true. So to this day, nobody really knows how this happened or even if it happened. Do you have any citations for the CIA memorandum in the appendix? That's the one that is the countering criticism of the Warren Report. And you can find that online. It's the famous one from 1967. And can you elaborate on the Hugh Ainsworth scuffle outside the courtroom? Well, no, actually, you know, I got that from my very first book. He's referring to the first edition of Destiny Betrayed. And that book was written so long ago that I don't really recall. That's probably in James Kirkwood's book, American Grotesque, okay? I sell books online, and I'm trying to have some niches. I'm slowly growing the JFK signed book category. Would you be open to sending me some signed cards for inserts? Well, yes, of course I would. Okay, so just go ahead and send them to me. Email me at Kennedy's and King, and I'll give you an address that you can send them to me at. Okay, that's Mr. Endicott. Okay, this is from a guy named Quentin Wrighty, February the 21st. Len and Jim, I love the Black Op radio show. Keep up the amazing work you are doing. Would you mind answering this question? Are there any amateur home videos of the JFK assassination that show any potential gun muzzle flashes that could be a gunshot. I don't think there are. What's that thing that Gary Mack and Jack White put together? You know what I'm talking about? Badge Man? The
Yeah,
Badge Man?
just the
Okay.
photo, right?
Yeah, but that's not a film. Okay, I don't think that's a film. All right, and Jack had to do a lot of enhancement to even get that out. So to answer your question, I don't think there is, but I will say this. If we ever got to Babushka Lady's photograph or film or whatever that is, I bet you we would. I bet, because that's from the other side, that's from the inside infield of Dealey Plaza, pointing towards the grassy knoll. Okay. And it's a close distance. All right. Thank you, Mr. Wrighty. All right. Richard Coleman. Hi, Jim and Len. Something I've wondered for. The limo slowed or stopped, but there was a lead car in front of it. Did it keep going at speed or slow down or stop first, forcing the limo to do likewise? If the latter, then I would suspect the driver of that car more than limo driver Greer perhaps being in on it. All right, this one is one I put up at the Education Forum. And what I found out was that Jesse Curry was a driver of that car. And he slowed down and actually put the brakes on at the sound of the first shot, which he said sounded like a firecracker to him. And then there were two other shots in rapid succession. Okay, and then a motorcycle driver, Cheney, came up and told him words to the effect that the president's been shot and the limousine exceeded the speed of that lead car and actually passed him up, okay, going on to the freeway entrance ramp. So that's the best answer I can give on that one. Okay, Mike Ramsdell asked me about a bullet through JBC, John Conley. Governor Conley would have gone through this back of the. No, it wouldn't have. The jump seats were just too short, and Conley was too tall. Okay, so that didn't happen. All right, and I got a little late on that one. Okay, February the 21st, Donald Friday. My question revolves around former Dallas Mayor Earl Cabell. Recently released files finally admit that he was a CIA asset. Before, during, and after the JFK assassination. However, the records do not elaborate. He was an asset, and there was a secrecy oath, 201 file sheet. Where's the beef? Do you know of any other files, such as operational files, that actually would speak to what the heck he was doing or speaking to the CIA about? To me, this is similar to the old limited hangout. There have to be related files still classified, if not destroyed, that explain the nature of this relationship or what information was being discussed. Are we supposed to believe that a president gets assassinated in the city where the mayor is a CIA asset and there's nothing to talk about? That's ridiculous. I have to say, I kind of agree with that. And one of the most amazing things about that document revealing that Cabell was the mayor of the city, was a CIA asset. It was in the NBR files. You know what that means? The NBR files, see, when the ARB was closing down and they couldn't finish everything they wanted to finish, they labeled a whole bunch of files that they really didn't examine, not believed relevant. Let me say that again. Not believed relevant. Earl Cabell being a CIA asset is not believed relevant? Are you kidding me? You know, but that shows you the haste with which they were shutting down at that time in 1998.
Or that there was somebody who was making sure that some things got labeled that way.
One or the other. But I agree with Mr. Donald Friday that there had to be something related to this. There had to be something in other files at the CIA that revealed more of the relationship. Let's never forget, this was the brother of Charles Cabell, and Charles Cabell was a deputy director of the CIA who Kennedy let go when he let Alan Dulles and Dick Bissell go over being deceived about the Bay of Pigs. Cabell and Bissell were really the operational officers on the Bay of Pigs invasion, you know? So I totally agree that this is truly a remarkable pit, you know, or whatever you want to call it, a hole, you know, that should have been explored by the ARB and should have been explored with vigor, you know. Exactly why was Cabell a CIA asset? And what was his files? What were the files at Cabell? Were there any operational files? Okay, was there a 201 file? You know, it's really, really, really puzzling. And it shows you one of the shortcomings of the review board, you know. Okay, February the 22nd, Elio DeMio. Hello, Len and Jim. Quick question for Black Op Radio. Could you explain the difference between Operation 40 and ZR Rifle? Were these programs being run in parallel by the CIA? Thanks and keep up the great work. All right. They were not, I believe, being run in parallel. Operation 40 was a top secret, and I mean top secret, covert op that was folded into the Bay of Pigs to the point that hardly anybody knew about it. And Helms only let Halpern in on it. Halpern was a really bad guy who liked to spread a lot of BS about Kennedy. But he was Helms' right-hand guy on Operation 40. Okay, after the fact, of course, because Helms had very little to do with Operation 40. All right, he found out about it later. And it was only spoken about, I believe, once by Frank Sturgis in a magazine article. In a nutshell, this is what I was able to discern about what Operation 40 really was. Operation 40 was a contingency plan, I believe, being run by Howard Hunt, in which if the Bay of Pigs succeeded, and that's a big if, then the Kennedy exiles, that is the liberal exiles, like Jure, you know, which Sylvia Odio was a part of, all right, and her father, they would not take power in Cuba. It would be the Howard Hunt Cubans that would take power in Cuba after Castro was defeated. And this, of course, means people like Manuel Aretin, all right, okay, who was Howard Hunt's golden boy. Okay, this thing was so hidden that it's very seldom even mentioned in the CIA files, okay? And I don't even think Kennedy knew about it. I think maybe Schlesinger might have told him about it later because he went down to Florida to check on some of the Cuban liberal leaders that were being more or less detained by the CIA during the Bay of Pigs invasion, you know? And Schlesinger went down there, and I think that's the way he found out about it. But I wrote about it in the second edition of Destiny Betrayed. I spent several pages explaining what it was. It took us that long to find out about this thing. Now, ZR Rifle is different. ZR Rifle is essentially a assassination program that was being run by Bill Harvey. And it was specifically designed to get rid of foreign leaders. All right. And I can tell you the two targets were Lumumba in the Congo and Castro in Cuba. They used several ways to try and get rid of Lumumba, including sending over QJ Wynn and WI Rogue. All right. And also sending over, you know, who was that? The guy who manufactured all those poisons. What was that doctor's name?
Gottlieb?
Yes, yes, Gottlieb. And Gottlieb put together some poisons to try and get rid of Castro. Okay, and we also know, of course, that Harvey and Rosselli were teamed up for the second phase of the Castro assassination plots, which never succeeded. So that was ZR Rifle as opposed to Operation 40. So thank you for that question, Elio. Okay. You know something? I can't find a name on this particular question.
Well, that's okay.
But anyway, unfortunately, I'll have to do this anonymously. I don't like doing that. Pat Spear describes a guy named Hank Farmer. Note what Spear says about Farmer. Farmer is a rarely discussed witness who's presumed to have stood in the plaza on the south side of Elm Street. This memo from Joe Pierce to Gordon Shanklin was never forwarded to FBI headquarters, but was discovered by Harold Weisberg in the Dallas files. Today at 5:36 p.m., Hank Farmer, 2862 Toronto, telephone Melrose 71637, Dallas, telephonically contacted the Dallas FBI office and advised he was standing on the southeast corner of Elm and Houston Street at the time when President Kennedy was shot. He stated he saw Kennedy hit by the bullet and felt that the bullet entered Kennedy's face. Entered Kennedy's face? He stated that he saw Governor Connally shot, and this shot entered Connally's back. Farmer stated, therefore, in his opinion, the two shots were fired by two individuals from opposite directions. Farmer stated he wishes to speak to an agent with this bureau and states that he will not talk to the Dallas police. All right. Okay, but it says here that he already was interviewed by the Dallas police on 11-22-63. The FBI found this out later. Mr. Hank Farmer advised he is a service station attendant at the Brock Station. On November 22, 1963, at approximately 12:15 p.m., he arrived at the Dallas County Courthouse to pay taxes. He was unaware there was to be a presidential motorcade passing by. He waited in the park at the corner of Houston and Elm Streets and watched a motorcade come west off Main Street onto Houston Street and then west on Elm. He stated he saw Kennedy appear to fall over in the car, and then he saw Connally also appear to fall over. He did not hear any shots fired and did not know what happened. He did not hear any shots fired. He was in Dealey Plaza. There was confusion with many people running in all directions, and the president's car drove off at a high rate of speed. Farmer stated he did not know what happened, but thought that both men had been shot, but he did not hear any shots. So this man, Farmer, saw Kennedy shot in the face and then saw Connally hit in the back. He says nothing about a third shot. Okay. I don't know what to make about this. I believe, but I'm not sure, okay, that Hank Farmer goes by the nickname of the Butcher. Okay. All right. And I believe that there was actually a thread on this at the education forum, okay, all right, and I think that you can probably find it, okay, if you go ahead and check out the education forum. Okay, here it is. All right, here it is. I found it. Okay, you can find it at the education forum. Apron Man, the Butcher of Elm Street, in a thread that began on January the 16th by Jerry Down. All right. Okay. He's in the background of the Zapruder film On the Grass. All right. All right. And some people contributed to this. Denise Hazelwood. Okay. Okay. I can see this is from Denise Hazelwood, the thing that I just read. Okay. So, and they quote Pat Spear there. And there's actually a picture of where he was standing. All right. I don't know how anybody can say that the guy has any credibility because, number one, Kennedy got hit in the face. I mean, what's the proof of that? I've never seen anything come close to that. And secondly, he didn't hear any shots. All right. Very, very weird. So I really don't know what to make of this guy. Okay, and I'm I'm it's not very often that I'm completely puzzled by somebody, but I have to say that I'm completely puzzled by this guy as to what he was referring to and whatever his significance is. Hank Farmer. That's a new one for me. Okay, so that's the last of the questions. Keep them coming because I know you will. And I previewed what's coming up at my Substack site, also at Kennedy's and King. This is the case that never dies. The case that never dies.
Well, you know, the failure is that the government refuses to release documents. So after 60
Right.
years, they said, oh no, we're not going to release them now. And so it's up to just interested civilians that have taken on the case. No, you know, like you say, even the HSCA, it seems to have been, well, we know from George Joannides, but some of the things they said, what was the acronym, the Do Not Release? Or,
No. Not believed relevant. That
Right,
was
not belief
ARB.
relevant. I mean,
Yeah, that was the ARB. Okay.
oh, okay, as well. Yeah, right. So even when you hear from Doug Horne that the higher ups in these things, you think there's a lot of people all working as one, but there's people in the very top there that thought Lee Oswald did it alone and was lone nut, and you just shake your head. But thanks to Black Op Radio and Kennedy's and King, somebody writes a new book or makes a new documentary, we'll bring it to your attention.
Well, I think that JFK Revisited and the recent book I contributed to, the JFK Assassination Chokeholds, I think that will eliminate, if anybody ever had any belief in the Warren Commission or the HSCA, I think that those two works really went ahead and put the kibosh on it and left us, where we are. I mean, now look, if this was an open and shut case, why are there still 4,000 documents being withheld? Why? What is there to hide 60 over 60 years after the fact? And we're creeping up on 61. So why conceal 4,000 documents if this is an open and shut case? And the answer to that question is that it was never an open and shut case. All right. And in fact, we know that because Barbara Shearer, who's the director of What the Doctors Saw, in that film, there is an absolutely stunning revelation by, I believe, Dr. McClelland that at the press conference that day at Parkland Hospital, we know that Kemp Clark and Malcolm Peary were the speakers. We know Kemp Clark suggested a large avulsive hole in the back of Kennedy's head. We know that Malcolm Peary spoke three times. About the neck wound having all the appearances of an entrance wound. All right. Well, McClellan says in that film that as Peary turned around to leave the podium, a well-dressed, official-looking man grabbed him by the elbow and said, "Don't you ever say that again." Now remember, that press conference started at 2 o'clock, around 2 o'clock, maybe a few minutes later. Kennedy is pronounced dead at about 1 o'clock, all right, officially. So, in the space of a little bit more than an hour, somebody knew that something had to be covered up. So, don't tell me this was ever an open and shut case, or else that would have never happened. And we also know, due to the work of Rob Cato, that that very night, Malcolm Peary was getting phone calls from Bethesda, telling him the same thing, that he had to be wrong about that being an entrance wound. And he said, these were from the doctors. A reporter named Stedman came down to Dallas and talked to Peary about a week after the assassination. And he said this to him. All right, they were trying to talk him out of his story about the entrance, an anterior neck wound being an entrance wound. And Peary resisted and said, I can't say that. I saw it close up. It looked like an entrance wound, not an exit wound. All right. And then they threatened to take him before a hearing, to take his license away. And so he said, look, I'm a hunter on top of being a surgeon. I know what an entrance wound looks like. I know what an exit wound looks like. This had all the appearances of being an entrance wound. And Stedman waited for a second, and then he asked him, well, standing as you are here today, do you still believe that it was an entrance wound? And he said, yes, I do. This is the pressure that was being brought to bear within less than 24 hours. And in the first case, it was like maybe an hour and a half, 90 minutes after the assassination. This is the kind of pressure. So this was never an open and shut case. There, the cover-up was clamped on almost immediately. Once Kennedy was dead, the cover-up began, all right? So that's why, because that cover-up was so intense, because it was so rigid, because it was so systematic, because it spread across almost all the institutions of society, that's why we're stuck in the situation that we are, okay? Here we are, 60 years later, still trying to figure this mess out, okay? So anyway, that's my sermon for the week.
All right. Thank you again for taking time, Jim. And
okay.
I'll speak to you soon, and I'll be got a couple of good guests lined up, so things are hopping here.
All right, Len. Keep it up. You got the best show on about this.
All right. Thank you. And
have
keep
a good
up,
night,
keep up
partner.
The good work with Kennedys and King.
Okay. Have a good night.
All right. Good night.